and now it is my pleasure to introduce the senator. It would be easy for me, by way of introduction, to read a list of Senator Lugar's accomplishments to you. It's an extremely long list, as you know, and I know you would be impressed. But a list of accomplishments, as important as it is, doesn't tell us about the spirit of the man. I want to tell you more. This busy and important man is taking time out of a schedule that's planned to the minute each day in order to spend the day with you and to encourage you to consider some of the most important issues facing us. Why is he being so generous with his time? James Freeman Clark, a 19th century writer and preacher, said that a politician is a man who thinks of the next election, while a statesman thinks of the next generation. Senator Lugar is the kind of man the word statesman was coined for. What a rarity that kind of person is. It is so difficult in Washington these days, much less around the world, for an individual to become universally admired and respected. But Senator Lugar is universally recognized and on both sides of the aisle for his intelligence and his fairness. His clarity of thought and his bipartisan style are the reasons he has been able to accomplish so many things, both here in Indiana and in Washington and around the world, including the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which is the most significant accomplishment in the world in reducing the threat of nuclear war. The program led to Nobel Prize nominations for Senators Lugar and Nunn, and it continues today. The senator has long promoted democracy around the world, and his work has influenced the lives of millions of people. Among his primary interests is you, tomorrow's leaders for Indiana. For these and countless other reasons, I'm especially honored to make an announcement here today. For more than 30 years, the University of Indianapolis has been the proud host site for the Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leaders. The university and the senator have partnered on this extraordinary experience for thousands of Indiana high school students like you, introducing them to the world of public service leadership. So today, in his honor, the University of Indianapolis is proud to announce the founding of the Richard G. Lugar Center for Tomorrow's Leaders, creating a permanent home for the Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leader, and creating new opportunities to develop generations of public leaders for Indiana. You will hear more about the center in the days to come, but right now, please join me in welcoming and congratulating our good friend and inspirational leader, Indiana Senator Richard G. Lugar.
Thank you very much. President Pitts, I am deeply honored by your announcement, and I deeply appreciate the generosity of your introduction and the hospitality of this university for each of our 31 opportunities to come together as citizens of Indiana, as young people, as parents, as teachers, as those deeply involved in the life and future of our country, to think seriously together and to have these very special moments. So I cherish the thought that this will continue for a long time. And as I understand from thoughts that you and others have had, and I appreciate the participation of Dr. Gene Seith, former president of this university, of Lou Gehrig, who was on the staff during the year that I had the privilege of teaching here at this university, between period that I served as mayor of Indianapolis and my coming to Washington to serve in the Senate, and of so many others who have had a stake, really, in the future of this university, but more importantly, in the future of Indiana young people. I want to take this opportunity today, as I try to do each year, to lay out very serious themes for the benefit of the seminar and the discussions that you will have, but likewise, really, for all the citizens of our state. This is one opportunity I have each year to make certain that we are in touch with almost all of the counties of our state, with significant persons selected simply by the fact that two outstanding students come from most of the high schools and preparatory schools in our state, often accompanied by teachers, parents, journalists, and others. And so I hope that that you will appreciate and enjoy at least the gravity of what I'm going to lay before you, because the responsibility for how it all comes out is most likely to lie in generations down the trail rather than in the specific times in which we live. I started with the thought that even as we meet here today in Indianapolis, a great number of world citizens are meeting in Bali to talk about climate change, about global warming, about the problems of carbon that bring about these dilemmas, that is, the rise of carbon in the climate. It's not a new subject, and it's one that has been widely popularized, and no doubt in many discussions you've had, people have tried to think seriously, is there a problem? And very clearly, scientists have disagreed as to the severity of the problem, or particularly the timelines of how the problem might become severe enough to affect any of us in Indiana or the United States, quite apart from those in the rest of the world. That debate will continue, and I treasure, as you do, the scientific evidence, the measurements of what is occurring. I am convinced personally that there has been a substantial increase in carbon in the atmosphere during recent years, and that is continuing at a fairly steady pace, and that there will be consequences of that. Whether one buys the thought of the pictures of glaciers melting, of polar bears in danger, of these specific situations often illustrated in the press, it is apparent, and this is being shared by statespersons in Bali generally, that there is a dilemma here, and that it is unlikely to be met very easily, and some pessimists would say it will never be met at all. If that is the case, then many of you will be coping as leaders in this state, in this country, with the consequences of that, in this country and internationally. Among the widely expected consequences, at least in the most immediate period of, say, two or three decades, would be at least a slight rising of the ocean levels. Some would see it more than slight, to the point that a sizable portion of the country of Bangladesh, for example, would come underwater or become uninhabitable for as many as 50 million people. In fact, leaving aside Bangladesh specifically, the consequences, as Martin Wolf in Financial Times pointed out this week, are likely to fall initially most heavily on the poor people of the world, who will be in the most vulnerable locations. Those of some stature and wealth will have taken the higher ground or moved to other geographical situations to avoid at least the immediate consequences. There are some who would say that, as a matter of fact, we don't know scientifically, precisely leaving aside the seas rising or the melting of ice caps and glaciers and so forth, what the effect will be on our weather, on weather patterns, whether there will be more hurricanes, tornadoes. In fact, in the case of our state of Indiana, one could say that if the temperature rose by 1, 2, or 3, or 4 degrees Fahrenheit, perhaps in some times of the year, this might be a more pleasant place to live. All things considered, maybe our crops might thrive a little bit better, and they might be right about that. However, our crops would not thrive if very extraordinary weather events hit us routinely in ways to which we have not become accustomed. Sort of felt that was the problem for Florida, the Gulf Coast, other situations. In short, we are playing with a great deal of science in the future, but we are also, at least as student leaders or as people involved with some public responsibility, trying to think through what if, at least prudently, thoughtfully, we took this at least slightly seriously, what would we do about it? So this leads to many debates in the Congress. We are confronted now in the Senate with energy legislation, which for the first time comes to a conclusion that probably we ought to get more mileage out of American automobiles and trucks, and that this ought not to be left simply to the market and to preference of consumers, as has been the case, but mandated by law. And not over 1 or 2 years of time, but over the next decade, so to speak. That, leaving aside climate change, might be a good idea for another big parallel theme that I want to talk about today, and that is that the United States now is forced to import about two-thirds of all of the oil that we use in this country. That percentage is rising, once again, not taking off precipitously, but moves ahead each year. The counterargument is that the United States has not exploited all the oil that we might in our offshore deposits or in Alaska. And we have those debates of environmental sciences each year. But even if we were to exploit those situations, no one predicts that that would mean more than a few years more supply. And I suppose that again and again, as I attend international events, I'm impressed with the fact that the whole business that used to be called Hulbert's Curve, Hulbert being one of the oil men who was predicting the future, said that at a certain point down the road, and some say this might be as early as 2015, 8 years from now to 2020, we will come to a significant conclusion as a world that well over half of the oil reserves that are in the world have been exploited and have been used. Mind you, not all of them, but half. In other words, we will be on the downward slope and that there won't be any more after that. And that that will lead to a very substantial pricing situation. By that I mean the price goes higher and stays there with regard to all of the use we make of petroleum reserves. I'm convinced after a conference in Latin America last week that that time is much closer for the United States. And I make that point because I discovered in the conference that half of the oil that we receive in the United States now comes from others in our hemisphere. Now you say, well, this is a fairly benign situation, much better than relying upon Persian Gulf oil, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, others that might have cutoffs because of wars, interdiction of shipping and so forth. But take a look at what our hemisphere suggests right now. For example, at the conference, I suggested, as I do routinely, though it's always provocative and has the same result, that the United States might assist the Pemex, the state-run oil company of Mexico, by very sizable investments. Why would we do that? Well, because Pemex now, as an oil company, has very obsolete machinery, equipment, processing. In short, whether it's discovering or exploiting more oil or simply processing what they have, they are able to produce less each year, on and on down the trail. So Mexicans provoked me to raise the question, as diplomatic as possible, would it be useful for the United States to invest $10 billion or some other big figure, because that would, in fact, enhance the wealth of Mexico very substantially. With oil prices, whether they be $70, $80, $90 a barrel, huge sums of money would come into Mexico. a situation often presented to us as one of not hopeless despair, but clearly over 100 million people living in a standard of living very, very far beyond, below ours, and therefore impelling desperate immigration and so forth. But very rapidly, Mexican patriots come back with the thought that Pemex is ours, Mexican. That oil is like our blood, Mexican blood. It is not to be tampered with by Americans. Even if the whole thing collapses, we don't produce any oil. In the judgment of some Mexican nationalists, that would be preferable than having Americans involved in it and working it through. An extreme attitude, you bet, but nevertheless, one in the realities of world politics very deeply held by those who are currently running the situation. Now, the new president of Mexico is trying to say, loosen up, loosen up. Maybe there's a way, somehow we can work this through internationally, maybe not just the United States, but maybe something greater, and I pray that he will, but he hasn't thus far. Or take the situation in Venezuela, very dramatic because of the pronouncements of Hugo Chavez, the president of the country, who does not care for the United States and has promoted diplomatically all sorts of anti-American diatribes around the world. Nevertheless, in fairness, Hugo Chavez and Venezuela have continued to export to the United States oil very steadily. There's been no cutoff. No really significant threat that would be cut off. A significant reason for this is that the money that Hugo Chavez utilizes in a very vigorous foreign policy, a foreign aid splashed around the hemisphere as well as abroad, comes from the oil wealth. One of the dilemmas pointed out in the Hugo Chavez regime is that so much foreign aid is pronounced, as well as other social services in Venezuela, that the oil facilities there are running down, and as a result, each year less oil is being produced, even though the price is right. There would be every reason to enhance the reserves and the production. A little different situation than Mexico, but one that leads to much the same sort of result down the trail. In other words, two of the largest suppliers to the United States that are fairly close at hand have reserves and the amounts that they can bring to us, which are diminishing. We still have the possibilities of the oil sands in Canada, and certainly a great deal of investment and work is occurring there. But it's very tough going, very tough conditions for workers in that situation. Pipeline disputes as to how it gets to the United States, even to us here in Indiana. You don't predict at this point that it'll diminish, but on the other hand, it may not be greatly enhanced. Now, in the midst of this, we have known that predicament for some time as Americans, but this has not changed visibly our use of oil. As Americans, we have lifestyles to which we've become accustomed and which we really do not want to change. And those that talk about other types of cars other than the ones that we have enjoyed, or SUVs or vans or trucks or things that are helpful for families and for other purposes, everyone understands the problem but does not feel it is particularly timely necessarily to act upon it. And this is understandable. In other countries, in Europe, for example, they have, through installation of very, very substantial taxes on petroleum, increased the price of gasoline to roughly double what we pay at the pump here in Indiana. That does cut down some demand, but not entirely. And the real problem there is that the incomes of people do not support buying as many cars and trucks as we have. I mention all this not in any sense of cynicism, but as the delegates converge upon Valley and look at each other eyeball to eyeball as to what various countries are prepared to do. The European countries would say, well, we adopted the so-called Kyoto Protocol so named after the city in Japan where nations came together well over a decade ago and pledged to start cutting the use of oil, the use of other fossil fuels, in essence, the carbon in the atmosphere. The United States did not sign the Kyoto Protocol, and regularly others have lectured us for our lack of diligence in this respect. But the United States took the position that essentially the so-called developing nations were left out of the picture. The Europeans, the United States, were prescribed as countries that have enjoyed a good lifestyle for quite a long while, had the full benefits of using fossil fuels, not only oil and natural gas, but coal. And so as a result, people in China and India, and I will dwell on them for a while, have said specifically, we still have the good times ahead of us. We are not going to be deprived of this. And furthermore, this is not just luxurious living. We Chinese, for example, are attempting to move as many as 500 million people from the countryside, the rural areas of China, to cities. This is a huge, massive situation internally that will create the need for huge infrastructure changes. Streets and roads, buildings, jobs, vehicles of some sort, transportation in urban areas of China where these people will be located, where they will be doing manufacturing or service jobs. So as a result, we have a lot of work to do before we get included in any so-called caps of what is there. So this has led to an interesting argument at Bali, in which some Europeans, perhaps a few people from the United States, have suggested, okay, what if the United States and the Europeans cut back by 80% the amount of carbon that we are using over the course, say, of the next 30 years of time, just hypothetically. We cut back 80%. And we only require you folks in China and India to cut back, say, 35%, less than half of that. That's acknowledging, perhaps, that you ought to have some of the good times rolling ahead before you really sort of begin to pull it in. Well, this was rejected severely by Indian statesmen who said that simply won't do. Even then, you will be enjoying life in a very different lifestyle than we will, and we're not going to accept this in any sort of world equity. And in short, even though Chinese statesmen have pointed out ways in which China might attempt to cut carbon, the facts of life are that at the rate we are told of about one a month, electric power stations are being set up in China that use what we would call dirty coal, much like coal we use in Indiana for similar situations. And one reason for this is that China has a lot of dirty coal. It does not have a lot of oil. And that leads to two problems. On the one hand, almost the certain use of a lot of that coal, which guarantees a high carbon content, an increase. And secondly, and this has an edge that goes beyond just an energy crisis, a very vigorous search for oil, a penning down of resources wherever they may be on this earth in a very competitive way. I had a visit in Libya 2 years ago at the behest of our government. I had been doing humanitarian rescue of prisoners taken by the Algerians 25 years ago in a desert war with Morocco. And these Moroccans were being held, and both countries felt that perhaps there might be an opening here, and I was utilized as a person to attempt to negotiate that down in the desert. And we got the 400 Moroccans out, and while I was over there, the State Department and the National Security Council said, why don't you go by Libya and see what you can do over there? No program or appointments or so forth. My first observation in the hotel and trip in Libya was that it seemed to be filled with people from China and India. And so I interviewed several of them in a friendly way as to why they were in Tripoli, Libya, and all of them were there for the same reason. They were attempting to pin down oil and natural gas reserves in Libya for the indefinite future, really to carve out whatever acres there were that were suspect of having these reserves for their two countries. Libya is not unique in those situations. As humanitarian groups in our country and those in public life have tried to help with the tragedies in Darfur, the situation often boils down to the fact that Chinese long ago were very aggressive in Sudan in getting oil, and they're getting a lot of oil out of there, and they're alliance with the government of Sudan has not led to much flexibility with regard to international rescue efforts, or the UN and the African Corps are all the things that have been suggested that might help in a humanitarian way. Our prayer really has to be that we do not come to a point in the next 20 years or so that countries desperate to keep their economies going, to keep their industry, their homes, and what have you, do not get into armed conflict over whose oil or natural gas reserves are whose. And that will take an enormous amount of statesmanship, simply sorting out the claims and the entreaties. And I suspect that many of you will be involved in that kind of diplomacy and in your preparation now to best to get ready for it, understand the countries involved and the stakes. It will be exacerbated, clearly, if the United States at that point still has the same extraordinary demands for oil and natural gas that we have now, because there will be at least a feeling on the part of many Americans that our history takes us all the way back to the 1930s, when in the Franklin Roosevelt administration, President Roosevelt sent emissaries to see the rulers of Saudi Arabia and to try to stabilize that relationship so that there would be, in fact, a supply of oil for us and customers for them. And the stability of that relationship still is at the heart of the OPEC situation, the oil-producing countries. And Saudi Arabia still remains a constant source of supply for us, even in the midst of the Al-Qaeda representatives who have originated from that country and various other terrorist representatives that are a problem for them. 2 years ago, for example, the price of oil spiked one day on the markets in this country. We could not tell for what reason, but the reason was that terrorists had headed down the road toward the largest refinery in Saudi Arabia. They got to the refinery. They were met by forces of Saudi Arabia, were all shot and killed, every one of them, before damage was done, quite apart from the closing of the refinery, which, if it had been hit, would have terminated 15% of the entire oil supply of the world that day. And thus, the futures markets anticipating that went wild on the upside. That is the precarious nature of the energy predicament. And on the other side, the nature of the global warming, as it informs the amount of carbon in the air. Now, the alternatives are at hand, but they are expensive and in some cases problematical. We in Indiana, in a very fledgling industry, have tried out ethanol from corn. I think it's a very important step forward. I would just say to all the skeptics, and they now abound, people writing articles such as this, God did not mean food to be used for fuel, or in a more economic way, people feeding poultry or livestock would say, you're driving the price of corn and other feed up. Our costs are going to be greater, and the food costs for the American people will increase. Others have universalized it even more. They said food prices are rising all over the world because Americans are using corn for fuel. And on it goes. Some would say the corn is not as efficient in cars as would be the regular petroleum. And that was more true 10 years ago than it is now, although there is still a differential in favor of petroleum. Some would say, as a matter of fact, that you cannot use fuel lines with corn ethanol. They will foul up the lines. Some truth to that. And as a result, almost all of the ethanol has to be shipped by rail. The backup of orders for rail cars in this country now is up to double what we usually produce, and therefore a lot isn't getting moved. And some would say this is a phenomenon, corn ethanol of 15 states, which Indiana is one, the middle of the country, but not very helpful if you're in California or the eastern coast and the trucks or the rail cars can't get to you very readily. Here in Indiana, leaving aside the problems in Massachusetts, we have barely 120 pumps anywhere in the whole state of Indiana in which you could get an E85 blend, 85% ethanol, 15% petroleum, and you could use that only if you had a so-called flex fuel car. There are less than 200,000 of these vehicles in our state. A year ago, with my staff, we took an energy tour and deliberately, in a flex fuel car, tried to make sure we went only to E85 pumps. We needed a very accurate road map of Indiana as to where these pumps are, so that we did not get into a situation of literally running out of gas. And even then, we found, as we celebrated each one of them, I left a senatorial certificate for what that's worth at each one of these places, extolling the virtues of their patriotism for what they were doing. But the intense opposition of the oil industry to all of this is palpable. Even at this point in our history, the difficulties of transport, the difficulties all around, remain that way. And so I just simply say this is sort of our first opportunity out of the box, and it's going rather haltingly. As I speak today, we are producing a lot of corn ethanol, and the distribution of this is a little bit sticky. And the price has come down, and this has discouraged some investors. Now, some would say not to worry. The real deal is going to be so-called cellulosic ethanol. This is not corn, it is fiber that's not food, won't affect the food price anywhere. If you ask what fiber, well, they would say, well, all sorts of things. We have, in the fields of Indiana, lots of things that could be chewed up. It might even involve some fast-growing yellowwood trees. Those make pretty good fiber. Quite apart from the so-called switchgrass in the West, which is often mentioned, well, I think that's great. And I've talked to inventors like Vinod Khosla. I mentioned him because here is somebody who made a lot of money in the internet business in California, but now is investing his own money, raising money in Wall Street, building plants in which you try out the chemistry of this, see what works. I'm convinced, as most are, that we're going to find cellulosic ethanol, and this will be helpful. But I am also of the opinion, given the problems of corn ethanol and its development, this is at least 5 to 10 years away, which is not particularly helpful, but still potentially out there. Encouraging in our state, in Anderson, at the research park, there are people dealing with hybrid engines. I've seen in the laboratories, layer after layer, until you get a square, and you put this together with other squares, and it forms the basis for a hybrid engine for a car or a bus or what have you. Exciting. People that have great automotive skills, engineering skills in our own state, trying to think through the whole hybrid business. I've been driving a Prius car for the last 2.5 years, which is sort of the first big introduction of this type of thing into automotive technology. It's a remarkable car. I get 50 miles to the gallon, and that I had never seen before, at least in my automotive life. It is not a large car, and it would not serve as an SUV. It does have comfort for five passengers. And for the work that I do, going back and forth to work and so forth, is sufficient. I'm eager, however, when I have hearings on this subject in the Senate, people say, well, you haven't seen anything yet. You need the plug-in Prius. This is one in which you will go into your garage at night, literally, plug something from the Prius into the wall. The electricity will come into the car overnight. And if you don't drive more than, say, 70 miles the next day, it'll all be on the basis of that hybrid engine being juiced up by what you put in overnight. You won't use any gasoline. Well, I said, that's pretty exciting. Where is the car? Well, there are some experiments. I saw one in Washington a few months ago. I think it works. I don't know what the mileage is. We're on the threshold of this. All I'm saying is that there are a lot of people out there trying to think through how we displace any of the current need, for petroleum. Our natural gas problems are not as acute. This country does import some, and will import some more, but by and large, not the same dilemma that we have. Our problem with coal is very acute, and it's a very local problem. We have a lot of coal that is still to be mined in this state. It's a value. Will the situation out at Edwardsport work? That's one in which people are trying to think through. Can you sequester the carbon, take the carbon out of the coal before you burn it? I hope so. But if you do, how do you store it? Physically, how do you get on with these stages that people glibly talk about so frequently? Encouraging thing is, some folks in this state are trying to do it. I would say their hazards are substantial, and public policy sometimes has not been particularly helpful. Now, at the end of the day, these sorts of things, I suspect, are likely to bring things to closure a little bit more rapidly. For the moment, we've had gas prices in the $3 category at the pump. The cost of oil in the futures market has hit $90, down to 87, I think, yesterday. What that is creating, in addition to simply problems for us income-wise, is huge masses of wealth in various places, most of which are not particularly friendly. I had a week in Russia, and essentially with my former partners, Senator Sam Nunn, we were surveying again, literally, the taking of missiles, or rather of warheads off of missiles, the storage of the plutonium and the uranium in safe ways, trying to think through how we, through a neutralization system, get rid of all the chemical weapons in Russia, 40,000 metric tons, a long way still to go, as well as in our country, and all these situations. But what I discovered with Russian friends is an attitude which, at least they were trying not to be obnoxious, but they would sit down at a table and they would say, Luger, you don't understand what's happened in the last 15 years since you started this non-Luger business, coming over here trying to help us destroy stuff and so forth. You've got to understand, we're rich. We're rich. We're back. We've paid off all of our debts. We're building up hundreds of billions of dollars of reserves that are going to be useful for investments, in quotes, or for whatever we may have. And as a matter of fact, we're going to continue to do that. We may become the wealthiest country in the world. Well, this is disputed by some on a per capita basis in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. Most of us have not visited Abu Dhabi, and I'm one of them. I've watched in amazement on television and by other photos the skyscrapers. You would think you have Manhattan rebuilt two or three times. And the fact is that the accumulation of so-called sovereign funds, meaning governmental funds, is occurring, the deposits are palpable, and this money is out there. Now, here's the situation that you will face as young leaders. China has built up its reserves not on the basis of $90 oil, but just simply on trade relationships, in which they've had a favorable balance of trade with us of over $200 billion for several years, and still mounting upward. So they have their own sovereign reserves in a different way. And all these countries are saying, you know, we here in China save 35% of our incomes. Ordinary people in small houses in China saving 35% on average of their money. The United States, the savings are arguably zero. Some generous people would say 1 to 2% after you deduct all credit card debt and every obligation we have. In short, at the federal government level, we have deficits between how much we spend and how much we take in of about $200 billion. That's down about $100 billion from a couple of years ago, but nevertheless, hardly in balance. Our trade balance with the rest of the world is out of kilter by about $700 billion. That is, we import $700 billion more than we are now exporting. How do we get by? Because China and other governments buy treasury bonds. They use the dollars they got to buy our debt and loan it back to us at interest. This is building up into the trillions of dollars. And those of you who are going to be representing Indiana in Congress will probably find that out and see it mounting a good bit more before you get there. Now, from the moment, the grand bargain seems to work. The Chinese, the Europeans, the Indians, and so forth say, we are exporting to the United States. We are gaining wealth in this way. This is engaging our people, our employment, our research, and what have you. Therefore, it's worth it to buy these treasury bonds from the Americans, sort of help keep their economy afloat. You say, well, keep it afloat? Well, the fact is that because they buy all these bonds, our interest rates have been unusually low. If we had to buy all of these bonds as Americans and bid up the price, interest rates would be demonstrably higher. Whatever the real estate crisis we have in this country, which now we are attempting to ameliorate by the Federal Reserve Board lowering interest rates, would be obviously much greater. As a matter of fact, we might never have come into a position in which so many people tried to buy homes at all. The mortgage rates would have been so demonstrably higher that that would be out of sight, hardly a good sign in our vibrant democracy in which home ownership is so important. In short, as you take a look at the balance sheet of the world, it is not necessarily moving in our favor. And yet we are counted upon with our armed forces to provide stability in the world, to keep the high seas free for everybody, to maintain order in all sorts of places on earth. And finally, we have ideals which are important: human rights, democracy, freedom of speech, expression, and so forth. Routinely, as Americans, we believe that this ought to be occurring in every country. And we don't understand why some countries value so-called stability as opposed to an immediate formulation of American democracy. Now, all of this could lead to very dire consequences, but let me just leave you with a constructive thought that whatever I've described today is substantially different than the dangers our country faced, say, in the first 10 or 12 of these 31 caucuses or seminars we've had together. In those particular years, the Russians alone, or then the Soviet Union, as it was more accurately described, had aimed at the United States 13,300 nuclear warheads, aimed at our cities, our military installations, with each one of these having really the ability to essentially obliterate a city the size of Indianapolis. Whether we understood the danger or not is immaterial. It was there. The weapons were there in the silos. There were armed guards and soldiers, not only in Russia, but in Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, all ready on watch all night. I remember the chilling effect that I had when I went into a silo in Ukraine, where it was a 13-story situation where the guard went down by elevator to Area 5 and did his watch for 5, 8, or 12 hours, as the case may be. And there were pictures on the walls of American cities, of presumably the targets, the particular missiles that he might have fired had as many as 8 to 10 warheads each that could have gone to different places, the so-called multiple reentry vehicle idea. That was the world until 1991. The world we're talking about today deals with finance, energy, innovation, our willingness and ability to invent and to move and to take correct political action and persuade others. It is not a situation of mutual annihilation, thank goodness. And we'll not come to that if, in fact, we begin to use the ingenuity and the spirit that is endemic in our republic and in our democracy. So that is our challenge. And there are good steps underway, but we could all accelerate that a great deal more. And my prayer is that the seminars that you will have today with very good people and the work you will be doing with teachers in the high schools of our state and in the universities that follow will lead you to a situation of assumption of public responsibility in a portion of your lives that will be significant in trying to solve the problems for us all. And I conclude by one story that a columnist for the New York Times gave not long ago after he visited China as to the difference between educational systems and leadership development. Oh, he was perhaps extreme in his description, but he suggested that in fairly wealthy Chinese families, where there might be only one child and four doting grandparents, as David Brooks posed the problem, he said these people point that child toward the meritocracy. From an early stage, a lot of rote memory, very disciplined thinking, and no time out in the academic course as you proceed through a series of examinations that are not necessarily one's a broad thought and differing points of view, but a great deal of memorization, blocks of information that are a part of your repertoire. That you proceed finally to an examination which only 9 million students are going to pass, a fairly small percentage out of the number that take this exam each year, and everything counts upon it. And if you pass, you are in the meritocracy. You may not be in government, you may be in finance, you may be in some form of business. You will do well. What of the others that did not pass? Life is not going to be so good. Prospects tail off rather visibly at that point. Suicide rates for students, very, very high. As they feel that life is, if not over, they've disappointed their parents, their heritage, the rest of it. A pretty grim spectacle. He said the irony is that we continue to think of Chinese as communists. In fact, he said this is an extraordinary, competitive, enterprise situation in which those who succeed do very well and, in fact, are real competitors of all of ours, whether one finds them in Tripoli, Libya, or wherever else you may find them. Well, thank goodness that is not our system. Each one of you as a student today has the freedom to think, to study, to do a lot of study or very little of it, to have discipline or lack of it, and so forth, and sort of hope the Lord will provide. But in any event, to appreciate that some people develop late and all the rest of it. Lots of fallback positions, lots of parents and teachers who are helpful as a safety net. Thank goodness. We're talking about no child left behind, and although this is very debatable and a subject all by itself, the concept is right, that our public school system ought to be one in which no child is left behind. We do everything possible for every child to have a go at it. And that's very important to each one of us in government who is at all involved in education. So I would say cheer for us. We're on the right track in a humanitarian, thoughtful way. But hopefully from our freedom will come a sense of discipline. People that will want to study, will read, will think, will imagine great things, will be prepared to act upon them. And we count upon a lot of those people being here with us today. Thank you very much.